You are listening to Believe, Strive, Achieve, Endurance Podcast with Diogo Custodio. If this is your first time listening, then thanks so much for coming. Get ready and enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Believe, Strive, Achieve, Endurance Podcast. My name is Diogo. Today, I have Philip Hatzis, who has a very special guest. Philip, who do we have with us today?
Hi, Diogo. How are you doing? Thank you for having me on again, and I'm looking forward to introducing you to Nick. Now, Nick is known to try training harder from the Altitude Center. So if you've been paying attention on social media, people will realize that we've just partnered with the Altitude Center, which is based in London, to offer support for our athletes. And we thought it would be a fantastic opportunity to get a real expert in extreme environments to come along and talk to us, myself, about what are we looking at with the services and the options that they have there, but also try and tie that back in again, because the minute anyone starts talking about altitude, probably 98% of the athletic population goes, well, that's obviously for the professionals and that's nothing to do with me. But actually, I think there's a lot there which the everyday athlete can take away from that. There's a lot that can be done around some of the other physiological training that they do, either through physiological testing or through heat environmental chambers that we can look at, which can actually be applied to, if you like, the everyday athletes, or the people who don't even believe that they're they need that side of things. So there's some really good hopefully gonna have some good conversations around exploring that. And then fundamentally, one of the great things they've just brought in London is the ability to do full physiological testing. And even if you don't want to go down that route, I think having an understanding what full physiological testing, and then we've got a few different options there, actually means, and why it's important for athletic development, is actually really important. If you're an endurance athlete and you have a bit of an understanding around that, your ability to then train, hit training sessions really well, and do the right sort of training at the right time will be really valuable.
Looking forward to it. Shall we go then?
Let's do it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Believe, Strive, Achieve Endurance Podcast. And I am delighted to say I'm here with Nick Hart from the Altitude Center. The Altitude Center is one of our new partners for the 2024 season, although we have been talking with Nick and the team at the Altitude Center for quite a few years now. So we'll use today's episode to really explore extreme environments and how they can be used for endurance training. So Nick, thank you very much for agreeing to join us on this podcast, and welcome.
No, thank you very much for having me, and it'd be nice to have a chat and hopefully help the athletes learn a little bit more about how they can make the most of the training they do and perform the best they can.
Brilliant, thank you. So before we dive into the science, I think it's really worth just explaining a little bit about how you came into the sport, how you came into working with the Altitude Center, and we'll explore a bit about what the Altitude Center does as well.
Yeah, so my background was, I'll call it a trying triathlete. I wouldn't class myself as a full triathlete. I've done a couple of 72.3s and raced reasonably well, but never made anything significant of it. But I'm a graduate of Loughborough University. I studied exercise physiology up there, and then specialised in environmental extremes, and was lucky enough to work at the Altitude Center on placement, actually, between my second and third years of university. And then after graduating, I was lucky enough again to come back full time. And my main role now is I deal with our triathlon side of things, our cycling side of things. And I do a little bit of work in the big mountains as well.
And tell us a little bit more then about what the Altitude Center does and how your day to day looks like or changes.
So the Altitude Center was set up 20 years ago. It was actually our 20th birthday a couple of weeks ago. And kind of the main philosophy of what we do is about bringing altitude training to the general population. In the sporting arm, altitude has always been seen as a very elite way to train. It's either been very expensive, very far-fetched, or just kind of feels out of the reach of the everyday person. And one thing that we truly believe is that altitude is for anybody, no matter what level you're competing at, whether you're looking to win the world, qualify for the world, or even just finish your first 70.3 or something like that. altitude training and a couple of the other measures that we'll have a chat about later can be used to allow you to basically maximize the training you do and kind of become as efficient as possible, if that makes sense.
No, it definitely does. And I think I'm most interested by the extremes element of what you just said as well, because when you think about most athletes and what they're doing, they are actually operating in the extreme in everyday life, because most of them have a full-time job, have families, and they don't have the most straightforward setup. So they actually already are operating in an extreme environment. It's just not necessarily one of the ones which we're ticking off as I'll go at high altitude or, heat or anything like that as well. So with the altitude, the three areas that you have, the services that you have on offer at the Altitude Center are complementary, but we're going to look into altitude training, heat training, and also the physiological testing, which is new things that you brought on since you moved to the new site. Where exactly is the site in London?
Yes, yeah, so when we moved on to our new home, we got a few new toys, which has been a lot of fun. So we are based in central London, so we're a couple of minutes walk from Liverpool Street Station.
And, I mean, I've been to the old location, but how many different sort of centres like yours are there?
In terms of the altitude centre itself, there is only one. It's what we do. There's a couple of sites spread across the UK that do stuff similar to ours, to what we do. And kind of all of the sites, whether they're through ourselves or other places that do it, they're all run by physiologists. And the whole idea is about maximizing performance for an athlete. And again, that is not looking at those looking to win Olympic gold or go and win at Kona. It's looking at your everyday athlete and just trying to allow them, again, make the most of every bit of training they do. We all do triathlon because we enjoy it. And part of the enjoyment is going as quick as possible. So if we can help you go a little bit quicker, then kind of all that hard work and training pays off, and you get that. Personally, I found I got a little bit more enjoyment from it, and that's the thing.
So before we dive into how altitude training or heat training can work, or how any of these services can work, I think we touched on it a little bit earlier as well. It's worth prefacing this that you guys work in a really sort of scientific manner, and it is obviously looking at how to get an edge on training, especially for athletes when they're sat there going, well, I can't add more hours. I can't do much more with the time I've got. So what can I do with that time? How can I be as efficient as possible? But we did have a bit of a conversation around the female information science and everything out there. So how do you find your role, how difficult do you find your role of balancing these extreme environments with the science, and then a female athlete coming along and saying, hey, how about me?
Yeah, it's a challenging one, because every athlete has a different set of circumstances. Some athletes have more time, some athletes have less time, some athletes are coming off injuries, some athletes aren't, some athletes are looking to go and race in cooler conditions, some are going to look at racing more extreme conditions. So it's very much a case of kind of you have to match the science to what an athlete needs, and there is a core foundation to what we do based in physiology, but from there it's very much individualized. And yeah, when it comes to female athletes, we had this chat off mic, but it is frustrating, because the majority of the older research in particular does tend to be very male dominated. So obviously you have to make the assumption that females react the same, but what is nice to see in the world of sports science is slowly things are changing, and there are studies being done specifically on certain elements of the kind of female physiology that may impact endurance performance that 5, 10, 15 years ago were either only done by a very few specific people or probably weren't even considered at all, if that makes sense.
And I guess from your guys' perspective, you were saying earlier that you have a high proportion of female members, I guess athletes or members within your the athlete centre across the high mountains and the training, the sports sort of science side of things. I guess you guys must be not quite world leaders, but you must have access to some pretty good range of data, even though the actual science papers aren't out there. So you've got pretty good insight into that as well.
Yeah, we're quite lucky. Obviously, all our data is independent, so it's not published and it's not shared, so it doesn't quite work in the same way. But yeah, we are lucky. We have collected data on some fairly unique individuals and some pretty incredible people, actually, to be honest. And that's ranging from some kind of ultra endurance athletes through to Olympic medalists through to people climbing, doing some really mad challenges. So probably the most famous one people heard of are things like 14 Peaks on Netflix, which is where Nims Purja climbed all 14 of the 8,000s. We were really lucky to be involved in that project with Nims and got some amazing data off him, which is really, really unique. And it's probably not something you can collect that easily in a scientific realm. But again, thankfully, we come at things slightly differently. So sometimes have access to data in slightly different ways.
And I guess you guys all being exercise physiologists can then take that unique access that you have and apply a scientific brain to it, so you can come up with some really magical suggestions.
That's been the aim. It seems to have worked so far. Yeah, it's a case of let's take the data and then, you know, again, I said it earlier, but it's just about helping an athlete. Like, whatever somebody's goal is, it's about helping the athlete achieve that goal. That could be climbing Kili, that could be qualifying for Kona, that could be doing your first 70. It could be anything. It's about taking you from where you are now to where you need to get to, and using the data to help us on that journey. Exactly the same way you do with an athlete. It's about using the data to take them from A to B, and hopefully they'll enjoy that process in the middle, which is quite a key part as well.
So I think if we start diving into a bit of the science then, I mentioned the kind of areas that the Altitude Centre has, especially now with the new premises, which if anyone has a chance and is in the area, you should definitely tap Nick up and go and have a look around, because it's really awesome. But one of the new features that you have is the exercise physiology lab. And I think it's probably worth starting with that, because that can help us understand a lot of the other reasonings why and how altitude training or heat training can really make an impact. So do you want to just talk us a little bit through what you have at the lab and then how athletes can use it? Anyone who's done a sports science degree, you might be familiar with certain test protocols, I'm sure. But yeah, talk us through what you have.
Yeah, so we're really lucky. When we moved into our new site, we were lucky enough to bring with us actually nearly a full physiology lab. So the majority of the equipment you'll find at kind of universities or things like that, thankfully, we've got access to here as well. And there's probably kind of two main sets of testing that we do, with a couple of other slightly different ones that people can use. So the two most famous sets of physiology testing you can do is either a VO2 max test, which is looking at kind of maximal aerobic consumption, or a blood lactate test, looking at blood lactate accumulation within the blood. On site, we can run both of those tests. We can run them independently, or we can run them in conjunction with each other. And the aim of that set of data is to go that next step beyond kind of FTP or critical power. You know, what we're looking at now is let's get some actual physiological data, whether it be blood, blood lactate accumulation or even breath by breath analysis, to understand how an individual looks as an athlete. So that can range from maybe peak fitness with a VO2 max or actually probably more importantly for an athlete and for their coach, you know, either looking at LT1 and LT2, so kind of those lactate threshold zones, or VT1, VT2, those ventilatory threshold zones, and allow an athlete to really apply a scientific approach to what they do. Because FTP is absolutely fantastic. It's the most common kind of type of testing we do as cyclists. But it actually doesn't have any scientific backing to it. It is very effective, but there's no scientific backing to what it is, whereas obviously VO2 max or blood lactate or any physiological testing actually gives us that next step. And for those athletes who are really looking to make sure that they nail every session and are very conscious of the zones that they're training, so zone 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, those famous 5-zone model we all know from Andy Coggan, you know, it's a case of, well, let's make sure those zones are correct, because if those zones are wrong, your whole training is wrong, or, you know, slightly out. So it's a case of redefining those zones. And then again, from an athlete's point of view, it's about monitoring progress. You know, it's a case of, okay, you can do the FTP again, and fantastic, that will give you a really nice progression. Or we can look at kind of going down the more scientific route and getting maybe a second VO2 max test done, where suddenly you're then looking at retesting data. So you can look at kind of, again, ventilatory thresholds, how they have moved, and start to look at other factors around kind of efficiency and things like that. So it's about going a little bit deeper than just kind of the superficial data and trying to get a much better understanding of that athlete rather than just a snapshot of maybe 20-minute power or something like that, or 5K performance if you're a runner, if that makes sense.
Definitely. I think before we go into it in a bit more detail, I do have a few questions. You defined the VO2 max, but I think for people listening, it'd be really useful just to define your LT1, what people mean by LT2. I'm going to throw out there, you can define what FTP or threshold is in layman's talk, and then what you really mean by it as well. And the same with V1, V2. I think just so that everyone understands what that is, and then I guess the question from that afterwards would really be, what does that actually mean for me as an athlete and listening now? How does that?
Those training zones that I mentioned there, or those physiology zones I mentioned there, shall I say, so LT1, LT2, or VT1, VT2, are basically kind of like markers that athlete can then use to track things moving forward. So we'll use lactate as an example. We define LT1 here at the Altitude Center as your first significant rise from base in your blood lactate readings. And it can almost be thought of as like your aerobic threshold. Okay. It's typically used to define kind of zone 1, zone 2. And it gives us the point at which your blood lactate rises above resting. And that indicates the point at which you are producing blood lactate faster than your body can remove it. So what that means is over time, blood lactate will continue to rise because you're exercising at a point using the anaerobic energy system where blood lactate is being, or lactate, I should say, sorry, or lactic acid is being produced as a byproduct. That is then obviously going into the bloodstream and causing blood lactate and therefore blood acidity to rise. LT2 is kind of defined as like the maximum lactate steady state. And that typically is not somewhere normally between kind of, normally around about zone 4. But this is the intensity that causes a rapid increase in blood lactate. And it is kind of the upper equilibrium between lactate production and clearance, if that makes sense. So that's kind of the point where you then start to see blood lactate. If you think of it like a graph, you know, you've got kind of a standard upwards curve, so to speak, for those that can visualize it. If you can't, just put it into Google and you'll get loads of pictures to understand it. But that's the point where the gradient of the graph really starts to take off. So kind of under LT1, you'll see a kind of a flat line. Between LT1 and LT2, you'll see like a gradual rise. And then after LT2, you'll see quite an aggressive rise, if that makes sense. And again, that can just help an athlete either redefine their zones or in some cases, you have a really, really simple 3-zone model, which again, just makes an athlete's life as easy, athlete and coach's life as easy as possible.
Yeah, I think sometimes I've heard the example of a bucket being used where you kind of have an inflow pipe going into a bucket with an outflow pipe, and you kind of initially the LT1 is that point where the lactate starts filling in the bucket because it's not draining away quickly enough, and then LT2 is where it starts going over top of the bucket, and you definitely notice there's a mess somewhere. But before then, you haven't really realised what's going on, and obviously from a racing perspective, that can make a big difference. If you think you're getting rid of lactate and actually you're not, then it'll come in to hurt you a little bit later on, especially for endurance athletes.
Yeah, the longer those races go on, kind of, you may think that, oh, I'm only kind of, you know, 10 watts over target power, 15 watts over target power, but 4 or 5 hours from now, you know, if you've been ever so slightly accumulating lactate for long periods of time or kind of gone over those thresholds, then it will come back to bite you because you're just in a position where your body is not able to basically sustain that intensity or the intensity maybe you want to sustain for significant periods of time.
And what does the VT1 and VT2 stand for then?
Yeah, so ventilatory thresholds, again, they tend to be fairly similar to LT1 and LT2, there's normally some slight differences between them. But as kind of a rough rule of thumb, VT1 is when a person can kind of no longer talk or kind of no longer be able to hold kind of a full conversation. It's that first significant rise in breathing, basically. So you might have said to your athletes, I want you to do a zone one run. You know, I want you to be able to hold a full conversation throughout that run. Typically, that is a very, very kind of ad hoc way of measuring VT1. You know, if you can hold a full conversation, you tend to be under VT1. VT2 is your second ventilatory threshold. And that is typically where they were kind of the rhythmic and controlled breathing pattern. You know, you always hear athletes say, oh, I found a breathing rhythm. That's where that tends to break down. And kind of your athlete tends to be under a fair amount of stress or duress. And again, it's typically associated with kind of the anaerobic threshold or lactate threshold. And it kind of shows the body moving into those higher zones and kind of a disruption to the body's ability to maintain control, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So you've got these 4, 5, 6 points if you use threshold and VO2 max as well to help give a bit of a fingerprint for an individual athlete, which with training should also change. So the benefits from an athlete's perspective is about that individualization of those training zones. And immediately the question then goes, well, what are those benefits for an you know, everyday athletes? They get those individualization, you know, they understand themselves a bit more. What are the real benefits there for that athlete?
Yeah, so it's about specificity. It's about understanding exactly where an athlete needs to be to get the most from a session. Like we spoke about it earlier, but you know, the majority of age groupers, which I think is fair to say where a lot of the work that you do is in, it's a case of maybe you want to train more, so there's just not enough hours in the day. Whether it's family or work or other commitments, they tend to be an inhibitor on training. So the reason that people use kind of services like yourselves, and I know you've been incredibly successful in it, it's about making the most of every single session that they do, and about making sure that at the time that they've got, they structure correctly, and they go to experts to do that. And it's very much a case of, okay, well, if we're going to structure the training correctly, that training will rely on either power or heart rate zones if you're running or cycling or threat or even kind of running speed zones or critical speed zones or whatever it is that you're using, but they still defined by that profile. Where the physiology testing comes in, maybe compared to field-based testing, is accuracy. It's a case of making sure that, okay, if we're going to use a zone-based model rather than maybe RPE or something else, let's make sure those zones are correct. Let's make sure that we have absolutely nailed those zones so we can make sure that when we come to do our session, so if coach says, right, we're going to do a zone 2 ride, do not go above X power, X heart rate, we know that is actually the top of zone 2. And maybe not creeping into zone 3, because you know that's a really key example that a lot of athletes make, is zone 2 actually feels really easy, but it's easy for a reason. And it's really easy to go, okay, this feels easy, I'm going to push a little bit harder. And suddenly you've gone from zone 3 to zone 4, zone 2 to zone 3. But going back to what we said earlier, you've actually gone from, you know, under LT1 to over LT1. You've gone from under VT1 to over VT1. And it's a case of, okay, let's make sure that we get those definitive marker points correct. And it's about accuracy at the end of the day and making the most of the sessions you do and making sure that everything is completely bespoke to you as an athlete.
I think that's a really important point to highlight as well, Nick, because if you've got someone who can only, say, train 10, 12 hours in a week and they've got a carefully curated plan, and this is what we're trying to do, this is the training effect, the energy system we're trying to train, this is what we're trying to do, and then for 50% of those hours they're not quite hitting it on the mark, then they've just half the effectiveness of that training time. They're still going to get training in, don't get that wrong, but it's not as efficient or as effective as they could make it, which is obviously a shame.
And that's exactly what it comes down to. It is about making sure that athlete has the best data and their coach has the best data to help that athlete as much as they can. And lab-based testing is always and is inherently more accurate than field-based.
And how might an athlete who is sort of fatigued or tired see those data points change? Like, is it only valid when they're super fresh, or is it something which they can see because they're tired and, oh, actually, I know how to adjust those?
Yeah, we typically tend to say for an athlete to get the best data, come in fresh. So it's normally done in a dope, the same way your coach would put a testing week in. You know, you might do your 4 to 6 week block, have your deload week with your testing in there, and then you start your next block. It's exactly the same thing. Like you would take out your FTP test and put in your physiology testing, so your lab-based testing. So we always say coming as fresh as possible because it gives us the best data and it allows us to kind of help an athlete as much as possible. Because you can, not always, but you can see those numbers impaired due to kind of high levels of fatigue or high levels of training stress.
And then they could take the zones that they have and apply them more effectively if they are tired, because they can see those changes, say, in heart rate, or it would less so in power, but I guess more heart rate.
That's a really difficult question because there's obviously going to be some slight variation within athletes. The same way you could say, okay, does my threshold heart rate and my FTP change as I go get more and more fatigued? Potentially it could do, but that again kind of comes down to an individual's recovery rate and things like that. So how we typically and how kind of any testing is used, not just physiology, but even field-based testing like FTP, is like we've got those zones. We know they're valid for the next kind of 4, 6, 8 weeks, depends on what an athlete is doing. And then we retest again if they see an improvement, a detriment, or kind of any changes. And then we move into the next block. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, perfect. So we can understand an athlete's physiology, and that's where the physiological testing can really help. So let's talk about your bread and butter. You know, it's in the name, altitude.
Yeah.
A lot of people will see that altitude training and think that is literally for those Olympians who are doing high altitude training camps and they're going crazy. And I think first things first, and I'm going to put it out there because I think it's the most impressive thing about what you guys do, is you bring the altitude to the athlete, which is always going to be a cheaper alternative than someone going to spend a few weeks or months, a year, at high altitude, unless they're fortunate enough to live there already. But let's just talk a little bit about how altitude training, or how, if you were going to attend a race, how that altitude would impact an athlete racing. Because I think that's a really nice way of then explaining to an athlete what is happening, and we can then explore how to train it to make it more efficient use of training.
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to say there is there's actually two avenues athletes can look towards. And coming back to what you said a second ago, yeah, altitude has always had the connotation of being elite and being kind of for the 1%, if that makes sense, which is true. You know, for those 1%, it does make a massive, massive difference. I think the stat is something like 95% of all endurance medals at the most recent Olympics have the athletes have undergone some sort of altitude camp. So that kind of tells you exactly how important it can be. But as I said at the very beginning, kind of the ethos of what we do is bringing that to the general population. And when it comes to altitude, as I said, there are two main ways you can train, and there's two very famous methodologies that we follow here. So the first is live high, train low, which is that classic go to altitude, sleep at altitude, come down from your mountain and go and train. And the second is live low, train high, which is what we do here on our site and is probably the area that has had the most research in the last 20 years. Okay. So going back to that first type of training then. So live high, train low. You know, that is your classic INEOS off the Mount TD. That is your classic endurance runner going to ITON. You know, you go to altitude for significant periods of time. Normally somewhere between 1,500 to 2,500 meters. So the most famous locations in Europe, you'll see Mount Tidi, Sierra Nevada, Fort Romelu. They're your kind of three big bases that you tend to see in Europe. And you'll go and sleep at these locations and either train there or drop down the valley or drop down the mountain slightly and then do your efforts at a lower altitude, 1,000, 1,500 meters, and then come back up again, which is fantastic. But A, as you said, it can be quite an expensive venture. And B, you know, you've got to be away from home 2, 3, 4 weeks. The way that we approach live high, train low is through hypoxic tents. So we've got hypoxic generators that can deliver the altitude, no worries at all. You put a tent over an individual's bed to create not a sealed environment, but a controlled environment. And then you can set that to whatever altitude is specific to that athlete. So your athlete could be sleeping at anywhere between kind of 1,600 and 2,500 meters overnight eliciting that red blood cell adaptation, eliciting that increase in EPO and all those traditional benefits that we know from altitude training. And then they come out of their tent, go to work, live their normal life, train at sea level. So the methodology would be live high from your sleep, train low, either on the turbo, out on the track, in the pool, or on the bike. And you can kind of follow exactly that methodology you would see at a altitude camp location, just done from the confines of your own home. So that's the first methodology. And then the second one, which is maybe even easier to apply to everyday life, as I said, is probably the area with the most kind of research investment in recent years, is live low, train high. So this is what we specialize in here on site. And this is where an individual lives low, so they just sleep at sea level, as we all do now. But they use intermittent hypoxic training, so training in a hypoxic environment, i.e. at altitude, to elicit a different arm of benefit. So this is, as I said, probably quite an interesting area for athletes to look at, and it's why we've got our chambers here on site. It's why we've built chambers all over the world. And this is looking at more of a muscular adaptation, or we know those kind of periphery adaptations rather than kind of hematological, so blood changes. So live low, train high is where an athlete would sleep at sea level, and then through the use of either an altitude mask if they're at home, or if they have access to a full hypoxic chamber or a controlled room, would train. So whether it be on a treadmill or a bike or even some strength training, something like that, they would undergo their efforts at somewhere around kind of 2,500 to 3,000 meters, which is kind of the perfect balancing point between altitude and intensity. And during that, and the course, the adaptations that would cause would be around muscular function, and it would be around the muscle's ability to use oxygen more efficiently and kind of help improve aerobic and anaerobic performances that way. So kind of the way to think of it is, and kind of where the modern world of altitude has gone, is you've got that traditional live high, train low, looking at changes in the blood, hematological. Or you've kind of got live low, train high, which is the new way of doing things, which is looking at muscular adaptation. Now, some athletes who are very lucky, who have access to an altitude generator, who can, at home, can do both. We do have athletes who we've worked with who do live high and then train high, train low. So, for example, they would sleep at altitude, do some of their sessions at sea level and some of their sessions at altitude. And that's where you suddenly get some really, really nice benefits around not only are you growing more red blood cells, so you're delivering more oxygen to those muscles, but the muscles, when the oxygen gets there, are more efficient with it as well. So you kind of get the best of both worlds looking at doing things that way, if that makes sense.
And to tie that back into the physiological testing points that you were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, essentially more oxygen, carrying capacity means that an athlete essentially finds the effort easier, or that what they are doing becomes easier because they've got more oxygen essentially.
Yeah, you undergo basically what's known as a right shift on those graphs that we spoke yeah. about. So VT1, VT2, LT1, LT2, they will shift to the right. So if that's on a bike, you produce more power to hit those thresholds, or if you're a runner running faster. And that basically means either an athlete can work longer aerobically or can just work harder for longer or produce a greater workload for the same metabolic stress, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So I think sometimes it's useful to think about what happens if I suddenly turn up to altitude and start trying to do my normal training routine, or I've decided to go and race Ironman 70.3 Boulder, if that still exists, but that's at altitude, and suddenly I kind of sit there in my normal race strategy, normal nutrition strategy, all those things, I've got it all lined up, it's just not going to work. But could you sort of talk through why me trying to do that wouldn't work? Because I think that sometimes helps explain the flip side of what you are trying to get the benefits out of altitude training.
Yeah, and I think the first thing to say there is obviously there's, again, altitude can be used in two ways. You can either use it to prepare for a race at altitude, and Boulder's a great example, or St. George is probably the one most people can relate to, 1,800 metres up on that big plateau. If you head to altitude and try to execute the same strategy that you would have done at sea level, there is a fairly good chance you won't perform as well as you think you will. Because your thresholds will shift ever so slightly to the left, because there's not as much oxygen in the air that you're breathing. Therefore, meaning that race power or race speed you wanted to is kind of slightly out. You're almost going too hard, basically, than as a mechanically you're putting the same load in, i.e. 200 watts or 4 minute Ks, but metabolically you're over that, so your body might feel like you're putting 220 watts out or 15 Ks now. So that's where the kind of the differences come. Again, from a nutrition point of view, you need to eat more and drink more when you go to altitude. It's just harder work, basically. So yeah, if you go to altitude and you're going to race at altitude, you will see a performance decline unless you're acclimatized. But I think the key is it's not just for those racing at altitude. Like, altitude training can be used for those racing at sea level, and that's kind of the real key. Like, you don't have to go to altitude to race at altitude. You know, a really famous example is like our history. So, you know, London 2012 was the most successful Olympics we've ever had. London has an altitude of about 6 meters, pretty much as sea level as it gets. But as a company, if we'd have been a country, we'd have come, I think, seventh or eighth on the medal table. Like, we did that much work in the build up to London, and that shows that, like, it is about training. It's about performance at sea level for the majority of athletes in the endurance world, not performance at altitude, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's a really useful point to make, because the benefits aren't for, as you say, those people going high and racing at an event, although obviously that is a reason to consider training, yeah. You know, doing some altitude training. And that's, I guess, probably the coach where most of the conversations we have with an athlete, they say, I'm going to a race, it's a little bit high, should I think about doing any sort of altitude training? In the same way I'm going to a hot race, should I think about doing any heat training? So it kind of almost comes up when the environment is placed upon them, as opposed to
environment driven. Yeah, it's environment driven, yeah, not exactly. Performance, and it's not performance driven. Like, if you've got an athlete who wants to qualify for the world, who wants to or is willing to invest fully in what they do, then it can make a significant difference. And you know, in the modern world, you can rent an altitude generator for less than an aero helmet. And you're sitting there going, well, I know which one's going to have a significantly bigger benefit in terms of your race day performance. And that, I think that's where kind of the mentality needs to shift. Before it's always been, right, I'm racing at altitude, I need to think about the altitude. It's a case of, right, I'm racing at sea level, how am I going to get faster? Okay, I can't train more. Can't train more efficiently. Okay, what additional training stimuli can I give myself to make the most of the hard work I'm doing? Altitude is one, heat is another, and again, it falls under the same lines of aerodynamics testing. Like, I know you guys do stuff with wind tunnels. It falls under the same bracket of nutrition. Like, okay, let's make sure I nail my nutrition strategy. You've done the hard yards. You've done the big hours on the bike, in the pool, on the roads. Like, you've done those bits. Now let's kind of build upon that and go from there, and I think that's really key. Like, altitude is not going to fix the fact you're not doing enough training. I hate to break it to you, but you can't make up for 6 hours training by using a tent. What you can do is, if you're doing 10 hours, make the most of those 10 hours and kind of really push yourself as hard as you can. And if you've got that big A race for the year, like, make sure you nail it, and it's small things that make the biggest difference. If that makes sense.
The couple of things that, as you're talking, kind of jumps out at me as really important points to kind of cover as well is, first of all, how does this look in the schedule? You mentioned an aero helmet versus an altitude generator being a very comparable conversation. What would a training program look like for an athlete if they were, you know, everyday person? They weren't looking at breaking any world records or anything on those lines, but they were looking to try and get the most out of their training. What would the training program look like? And I guess also, what would that interaction with yourselves look like? Because you and I have had conversations about how that coach/altitude center conversation works, and it's quite a nice one. So it'd be great just to talk a little bit about what that training program, how that training program gets put together, how then it's integrated into the current training with the coach as well.
Yeah, so the first thing there is obviously decide what type you want to do. Either live high, train low, you know, with a tent, or live low, train high, like via a mask based or exercising at altitude. And then from there, it's the key physiologies we have is altitude fits you, not you fit the altitude. Okay, like, the altitude fits your training, not the other way around. And in terms of kind of dosages and things like that, independent research shows you need normally a minimum of 21 to 28 days sleeping at altitude to elicit a significant adaptation. So if you've got your big race, you need to be thinking kind of a month out to start start your training. And the way that we partner with coaches is we're there to support and help with any questions that they need. All our systems come across with a full training plan and everything like that. And then if an athlete wants additional support from one of the physiologists, we will happily come on board as a almost like a consult for 3 or 4 weeks, help you learn how to use it and kind of learn how it's best for you to make the most from it. And then you've kind of, again, not only had the physiological adaptation of training out to you, but you've gained a bit of knowledge as well. From the live low, train high, again, it's about integrating it into a training program. So it's about fitting in your altitude session, so to speak, with whatever your coach is giving you. And typically speaking, and what the research shows, is the best way to make live low, train high work is either to do your very easy sessions at altitude, so your zone one, zone two recovery stuff, or your very hard sessions, typically high zone four, low zone five work at altitude as well. We tend to say try not to do your threshold or your VO2 max sessions at altitude just because you can't hit your numbers. Like one of the drawbacks of live, one of the reasons that athletes who live high come down the mountain to train, you know, live low, train high. If you're in TD, you descend down to the roads, do your efforts to come back up. It's because when you're at altitude, there isn't enough oxygen to produce the power that you need. Therefore, you don't, or the speed you need if you're running. Therefore, you don't actually get the muscular adaptations that that session is intending. So we always say try and do your easy sessions or your hard sessions at altitude, and then kind of the threshold tempo work, if you do have any, do that at sea level where you can kind of really maximize it and make the most from it and hit the numbers your coach needs you to hit.
One question which also I wanted to ask around the living high, training low impact is, how much would that impact someone's recovery?
When done incorrectly, it can have quite a significant impact. You know, there's always really famous stories of normally cyclists, to be honest, coming off altitude camps, feeling tired, feeling cooked. And I guarantee every single Grand Tour you'll listen to, you'll hear somebody on the commentary go, oh, he's just come off an altitude camp and he hasn't quite recovered from it. Essentially, if an athlete goes too high, too fast, and we're only talking kind of 2,000 meters here. You're not talking kind of altitude sickness levels. But when you're an athlete, you need to recover from your sessions. Recovery is key. If you go too high or an athlete is sleeping too high, then their recovery will be impaired. But that's one thing we're really hot on here on site. And by using an altitude generator, they're completely adjustable. The generators themselves can do anything from kind of 1,500 up to 3,500 meters. So if an athlete is somebody who maybe doesn't deal with altitude as well or is struggling with the recovery side of things, you can drop the level of the altitude down, almost come down that mountain slightly, still allow them to get the benefits that altitude training brings whilst also making sure they maintain their recovery from their session. And then over time, as they acclimatize, you bring the altitude up and up and up to the levels that their kind of colleagues may have been at or kind of race partners may have been at for a couple of weeks. And that's where the individualization comes in. And it's just something you can't do when you're on the mountain because you just can't find a hut lower down because they just don't exist. But it is something you can do with a hypoxic generator just because of the adjustability of them, basically.
And what are the other risks of altitude training, or I guess common pitfalls that people make around altitude training, or even just general myths?
The biggest mistake people make is about the recovery. You touched on it actually just without meaning to, and it's going too high, too fast, and thinking, right, I have to sleep at 2,500 meters every single night because that's what the pros do. That isn't the case. It very much is a case of altitude has to match you. And there's many a case of athletes I've worked with who have had very stressful days at work or really heavy training days or just need a bit of a rest, like for unknown reasons or other reasons. Like, they can come out of that tent for a night, get a good night's sleep and recover, and then go back in the tent the next night. It just gives you that adjustability. And the only other two things an athlete would probably need to consider or may want to consider would be around hydration. If you're sleeping in an altitude tent or you go on an actual altitude camp, if you're lucky enough to, you're probably going to want to drink somewhere between 0.5 liter to 1 liter extra per day just to help with the diuretic effect that altitude can have. And just help your body kind of maintain kind of blood viscosity levels and one or two other kind of hormonal factors.
And the other area which you haven't mentioned yet, but is a really good benefit of being able to train at altitude, this would be more of the live low, train high option is if you've got someone who's injured. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, so it's, so that's a huge amount of work we've done around rehab. So essentially the methodology behind it comes from the fact that if you've got an athlete who's injured, who's very much struggling to load their body, i.e. you're coming back from plantar fasciitis, shin splint, ITB, typically we're more looking down the runner's line here as that's the normal course of injury, or particularly load-bearing injuries that triathletes see. That athlete may not either be able to run very hard, run very fast, or put a lot of mileage in, so you'll actually see a regression in their fitness. One thing that we will look to do is get them to do the running or the exercise they can do in that modality. We'll look to get them to altitude, because what you'll essentially see there is you will maintain the mechanical stress, i.e. running 10Ks an hour outside, or 6 minute kilometers outside, or six minute kilometers inside. It's still running 6 minute kilometers, like it's still the same mechanical load, but because you're in hypoxia, not normoxia, so you're at altitude, not sea level, you'll see a much larger metabolic load. So heart rate is the biggest one you'll see. Heart rate will rise higher. So a nice way to think of it is you may get an athlete in running in zone one, but heart rate in zone three. So suddenly when they are able to then increase their volume and they start to recover from that injury, their fitness, or they've maintained a significantly larger amount of their fitness level. Therefore, they're much closer to either race prep, or they're kind of further down that rehab journey. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's a really, again, for athletes who haven't got that time, but they're looking at races and they suddenly pick up that injury, it's almost a no-brainer to kind of keep themselves ticking along with fitness and being able to put in the hard intensity training things. And again, because it's training high, you can still make sure you're absolutely recovering and doing the other good stuff that you need to recover from the injury as well.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It means that athlete can actually recover from that injury, because if they're not going to recover, they can't race. But at the same time, they can maintain that fitness level, so that when they do get back to full training volume, they haven't had kind of that fitness drop off that sometimes we associate with an injury, or less of a fitness drop off.
And then to segue ourselves nicely into the other extreme environment, which we were going to talk about today, there is meant to be some research around heat training and using heat training as a substitute for altitude training.
Heat has for quite a long time actually been known as the poor man's altitude. And there's a really interesting reason for that. So one of the adaptations you see from heat training is an increase in blood plasma. So if you see an increase in blood plasma, so the amount of blood we have, what happens there is the red blood cells we have become more diluted. So if you think of it almost like like putting sugar in some water. If you put 10 grams of sugar in 100 milliliters of water, you've got 1 to 10. If you put 10 grams of sugar into 200 milliliters of water, you've suddenly got 1 to 20. And what that triggers in the body is the body detects that low dilution of red blood cells and triggers an EPO cycle. So that EPO cycle then increases and grows more red blood cells. So suddenly you've got an athlete who's got increased blood plasma, i.e. blood volume, but an increase in red blood cell count as well, exactly the same as you would have seen at exactly the same as you'd see from an altitude count.
So that would be obviously one benefit of heat training. And as I said, it moves us really nicely into the heat training side of things, which is a new addition to the new site that you have as a heat chamber.
Yes, it's a lot of fun. Well, I say a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun for us. It's not always as much fun for the athletes. But I think heat's a really interesting one, a really, really interesting one, because we'll see. So if I say to you, Phil, like if I'm on a hot condition, what would you consider would be a hot condition for one of your athletes going to race?
Okay, so I have to be quite careful here, because I love racing in the heat. So for me, if it was anything less than 25 degrees, I was like, that is a freezing cold race. I liked to be like, I really like racing around 30 degrees. That was my kind of preference. But I appreciate that I have Greek blood in me, and most British people find anything above 10 degrees really, really quite hot. But I think most people, to answer your question, if they were going somewhere where they felt was warm, it would be somewhere where the kind of the advertising and the marketing is talking about it being quite warm. So I think quite a lot of people would miss sort of say even France being as a warm destination, because it is hot, but it's just where you go for holiday. But actually, I mean, I guess most people really think about it when it started saying, oh, I'm going to 30, 35 degree temperature races and or humidity or something like that.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of athletes fall foul. You know, there's a lot of research out there, and there's some really interesting research out there around heat and kind of detriment in heat performance. So one really classic study that was done was they took three-hour marathon runners. So good marathon runners, but in the grand scheme of marathon running, maybe not top-notch. Good runners, but not top-notch. And they saw they got them to run a marathon in 10 degrees and a marathon in 15 degrees. Now, 15 degrees is what? It's a spring day. No, that's not particularly hot at the end of the day. But they saw those athletes, on average, performance decline was 8 minutes over a three-hour marathon by going from 10 degrees to 15 degrees. Now, 8 minutes at 15 degrees drop-off compared to 10 is quite a lot. And that was surprising to me. And it was surprising to a lot of people when that research came out, kind of the detriment that you can see. And another really good example was they did a time trial performance with athletes at normal temperatures, kind of 10, 12 degrees, and then at 25 degrees. And they saw a 6.5% drop-off in time trial performance over half an hour. Now, 6.5% drop-off in power is massive. Mm. And that's only at 25 degrees. Now, you look at Staffordshire over the last 3 years, and I actually did some research on this just when our heat chamber launched. Somewhere between 70 to 90% of European races over the last couple of years have been 20 to 25 degrees or above. Now, triathlon is a summer sport because we swim in a lake and that gets really cold in winter. But the detriment of that comes with the heat. And, you know, at 25 degrees, and that was actually in elite Australian cyclists. So these are people who are fairly well adapted to the heat already. They saw a 6.5% drop off in half an hour time trial performance. And the rough rule of thumb is every degree you go above 37, you drop about 5% in power. And that is huge. You know, in the past, we've only thought of heat as Kona, you know, 30, 35 degrees. Like, you know, when you actually feel the heat, if you're feeling the heat, you've already had a big performance drop off. Again, for those athletes who are really trying to make the most of performance and make the most of the opportunity they've got to race, like, it's a whole different podcast we can go on to, but triathlon in some races has become very expensive. I mean, if you've invested in that one race for the year and you want to nail it, if it is going to be 25 or 30 degrees, you can actually have a significant advantage on either if you're looking to qualify for certain things or on the competitors, or if you're looking to hit a certain time, you are significantly more likely to do it. And again, another really good example is they took 10K runners. So these were athletes who were fairly decent runners again. I think the average finishing time was somewhere between kind of 40 to 60 minutes. So off the bike, I think 40 to 60 minutes is a fairly decent push for most runners off, if you think of an Olympic triathlon. And they got them to run it at 10K, at 25 degrees and 35 degrees. So starting pretty hot already. And they saw a significant decline in finishing performance. The average athlete finished about 7 minutes slower, going from 25 to 35 degrees. And if you take that into consideration to what we spoke about, at 10 to 15 already, you know, going from 10 degrees to 35 degrees, you can see some pretty significant changes in performance. And it all comes down to the body's inability to regulate or inability to thermoregulate. And that leads to a whole world of issues ranging from either kind of fuel utilization to psychological factors to, in some quite bad cases, particularly in very hot conditions, kind of heat-related illnesses as well, heat stroke, that sort of thing.
I think I know what the answer to this question is going to be, given the previous topic on, the previous two topics. But I'll ask it anyway, because it'll be good to get it out.
Yeah.
So the methodology that you guys take then with heat training, you've got the heat chamber on site.
Yeah.
I guess your answer is going to be the individualization approach for the athlete. But what's the benefit of actually coming on board and really kind of getting to grips with your own heat thing, as opposed to locking yourself into the, I think the old school Ironman approach was lock yourself into the bathroom, turn the shower on, and onto hot, and then get training and do a turbo session in there or something like that.
Yeah, it's two things. Number one, that just isn't hot enough. At the end of the day, our chamber does 38 degrees and 70% humidity. Like, that's hot. Like, that is really hot. And it's also, to an extent, athlete safety. like if you're doing it at home, and at home heat acclimation does have a place, but you have no ability to monitor your own core temperature. Like you have no idea where you are on a spectrum. You might be under a certain threshold, so not actually eliciting massive benefits, but just having a really horrible time. Or maybe more dangerously, you could be over exposing yourself and actually putting yourself in a slightly more dangerous position, but kind of heat stress or heat stroke come into it. So again, it's about doing it in a controlled way. Every session that we do here on site, you wear a core temperature sensor. So we've invested in a new type of technology called core body temp, which is non-invasive. So thankfully, we've moved away from the whole days of rectal and things like that, which were never that popular with athletes. And we get a continuous data trace. And it's about making sure an athlete makes the most of it. So when you come to us to do a heat session, we'll put you through a heat stress test. We'll understand your heat training zone. So you have power zones, you have running zones. We'll give you some core temperature zones. And then when you go through an acclimatization strategy, which is normally 5 to 10 hours in the last 5 to 10 days before you go and race, we'll make sure you stay within those core temperature zones that have been identified for you to make sure A, you're safe, and B, you make the most from those sessions.
And just as a general question, really, we talked about living high, training low. Is there such a thing as living hot, training cold? I guess that's the Southern French athlete moving to race in the UK for a little bit. But is there adaptations which take place? I jokingly said I've got Greek blood in me, and I like heat. Is there something around that genetically or environmentally where people who live in warmer places tend to find that their adaptations starts a little bit higher?
You tend to see endurance athletes in general tend to have a better tolerance to the heat. Like for the average individual, for the average athlete, if you get an athlete up and around 39, even 39.5 degrees, that's hot. Mm-hmm. Like you'll get a lot of athletes struggling there. But when the World Cycling, the UCI had their time trial in Dubai with that great idea. They regularly clocked athletes at well over 40 degrees core temp. Now that would put a lot of everyday athletes into hospital just with heat stress. Heat stroke and probably even worse symptoms than that. But endurance athletes have an ability to get their core temperature higher and sustain it. And I think Gabriel Haile Selassie was one that when he won the Dubai Marathon, his core body temp was clocked at something like 41.2, 41.3, which is just silly hot. I mean, that's getting to the point where people will quite literally be losing their life at that sort of temperatures. But as a well-trained performance athlete, he could cope with it. So yes, very well-trained athletes can deal with it better, but then very well-trained athletes have a much tighter window for performance. You know, as an amateur, you might lose 10 minutes and still win your age group. If you go and lose 10 minutes at Kona, you've gone from 5th to 15th, if that makes sense. So yes, they deal with it better, but the performance windows are tighter, if that makes sense.
We just also define that difference in terms of core temperature. I know you talked about core sensors, but talk about core body temperature. And then, I've got a thermometer in my gym. It says it's 28 degrees, so therefore I'm heat training. What are we talking about in terms of those differences there?
Yeah, so what we're looking at there, when I say core temperature, that is your the body temperature internally. So that is your core internal body temperature. And that is a combination of the external temperature that's being put into you, as well as the metabolic heat that your body's producing. That is the most important factor, because you need to regulate your metabolic, your core temperature, ideally kind of 37, 38 degrees. That's probably where you want your athlete, because that's where they see very little drop off in physical performance in around those sort of temperatures. And that's where the athlete can be as efficient as possible. When core temperature starts rising above, 37s into the 38, that's where you then start to see that drop off in performance. And that is again down to heat related issues. So that could be either psychological, physiological, it can link to dehydration, a whole range of factors come into play that athlete is then struggling with. And it's about trying to stop an athlete from getting to that point, or if they are going to get to that point, because Staffage is 32 degrees, or Nice is 35 degrees, or Mallorca is 31 degrees, or Challenge Roth is 29 degrees. Like, you just can't avoid it, minimizing that as much as possible, so they see as little performance drop off as they can, basically.
And if we look at the big cycle, so you've got the heat, you've got altitude, what we're trying to do is get bringing that whole extreme environmental awareness. What would be the ideal structure for that person who doesn't have the time to spend, you know, an extra 20-30 hours a week on training, and they need to bring the training to them? What would that whole season look like? Because you mentioned the last 4 or 5 days before for heat training, you mentioned 21 days for living high. Are we looking at kind of periods throughout the season you could use it, so you can kind of get adapted quicker before you head out on site?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question, because obviously one thing that we prioritise ourselves here on and specialise in is non-elite situations. So non-elite situations, i.e. amateurs, don't have a perfect plan. There is no one thing like that you have to do. It's very much a case of that any one of the things that we spoke about will benefit an athlete. So whether it's physiology testing in winter to then now to then have a good winter training block, or if it's, you know, sleeping at altitude in the weeks leading up to your A race to increase red blood cell count to then, you know, make sure that you can perform the best on the day there, or if it's those in London regularly train in a live low train high situation to elicit muscular adaptations to be more efficient with altitude, or if you're heading off to go and race anywhere that's going to be over 20 degrees, basically understanding that heat related issues, not heat stress or heat stroke, but negative impact heat can have on performance, using that in the last 4 or 5 days during your taper to get ready there. So I'm not a massive fan of going like this is what somebody has to do, because it is whatever suits an athlete. And like, yes, if you gave me an Olympian, which people have done, and say, what do we need to do? It's great, because you can just do everything.
Yeah.
But so do you, family, home, job. Like, I don't have the ability to do everything. So it's a case of whatever fits that athlete is best. Typically, we found the least invasive to everyday life is live low, train high, because essentially you've got a generator at home, you've already got your turbo set up, you've already got your treadmill set up, and basically you do the session you're already going to do, you just do it at altitude. Like, that's the least invasive way to do things. And the second least invasive way to do things is through heat acclimation, because you would go to a site, do your session as you normally might do at the gym, and then go back home again. Putting a tent over the bed and that side of things tends to be a little bit harder sometimes to do, whether logistically you may have other significant others involved in it or other things like that. It becomes a little bit harder. The benefits of, you know, if you can make it work, the benefits are worth it. But in terms of kind of the least invasive, or the ones that cause the least disruption to everyday life, you're looking at kind of physiology testing, live low, train high, or kind of heat acclimation in the last kind of 4 to 5 days for most athletes.
Yeah, totally. And I think the great thing, as I mentioned, I think the opening statement about what you guys are doing is you bring this basically for less than the price of a race entry. If someone sat there, and some of the heat stuff is way, way under that. And so you look at it, you're like, well, if I was to just go and sign up for a very expensive race as the main race I want to go away and do, now, actually, it's a really sensible thing to make sure you utilize the time that you have, if you can't then go and invest loads and loads and loads of time or money into it.
Yeah, I'm a big cyclist myself. That's my sport now. And I was looking at a new pair of race wheels because I like big, nice, shiny things. And it clocked me that I could actually own an altitude generator and tent for life for less than a set of wheels. And you're sitting there going like that. So you could have a lifetime of altitude camps for less than the set of like a pair of zip wheels. And I think that's probably the key. It's just kind of, we all like nice new shiny things, and turning up to the club ride on a brand new bike is why we all do this, let's be honest. But sometimes you can actually invest money or invest time, which is sometimes more valuable in better ways. And it is just a case of sitting down and going, okay, right, how am I going to make the most of every single session I do? If I'm going to drag myself out of bed at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, I'm going to head to the gym before work or do that session before work so I get it done so my coach doesn't moan at me. Okay, if I'm going to get up or stay late or whatever, how am I going to make absolutely everything from this count? And that's where our expertise lies, about making the most of every single session that you do. And that's the big takeaway point.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it is, I'll reiterate it isn't about those high, I mean, it isn't just about the top end Olympians or people trying to win stuff overall. It is about, if you've got everything else in the line, as you said, you still have to do the training, if all those things are going well, yeah, and you've got a good setup and you're doing really well, this is actually a relatively low cost but substantial benefit change that you can make by addressing the extreme environments for training, which is fantastic.
Yeah, you know, for as little as, I say as little, it's not a small sum of money, but, you know, to give you a ballpark, like a 1 month rental would be, so if someone just have a generator come to the house and they'd have unlimited use for it for a month, you'd be looking at over £500, which, okay, it's not cheap, but it's, you know, not that dissimilar from, you know, the brand new skin suits that are coming out or some of the latest equipment that's coming out. It's not massively different from that. And on the heat side of things, you can look at adaptations in even shorter periods of time than that. And then obviously our site in London is probably the cheapest of all of our options because we've got a fully fledged altitude chamber that is on all day, every day. And you just use it like your normal gym. Like a lot of people in the city just have a gym, like a membership with us. You might be a member of your Virgin Active or something like that. People just do that here. So they have unlimited access to our site and spend all their time not working, or when they are training, they do it all on a watt bike, because if you're going to do it properly, and then do it all at altitude as well, which is, again, just trying to make the most of every single hour and every single bit of suffering you put yourself through, just make it worth that little bit more.
I could not agree more. Nick, thank you very much for all of that. Before I let you go, I'm going to ask you a few quickfire questions that we ask every guest on the podcast. So, quick answers. First one up is, what does Believe, Strive, Achieve mean to you? How is it applied in your experiences?
For me, Believe, Strive, Achieve is about picking out a goal that you want and then going out there and getting it. You know, it's very easy to say, like, I want to go and do that. For me, it's about going out there and actually putting a plan in place and actioning that so you can achieve whatever you want to achieve. And that doesn't matter what it is, as long as you kind of put the work in. And I always use this motto with our clients. But as long as you stand on the start line knowing you've done everything that you want to do, you're going to have a good race.
What's your favorite race or bucket list event that either you've done or you'd like to do?
That is a very, very difficult one for me. Mine will probably be a little bit unique, but I like the idea of doing something like the mountain bike yak race or like the Silk Road, which is a combination of high altitude and bike riding. It's a little bit of a unique one, but touring across the like Turkmenistan and Tajikistan and all those places on a gravel bike looks a huge amount of fun.
I was interested in that question, and also what has been your best sporting memory? Just given kind of the people, the environment that you're working in, I think there must be lots of them. But
yeah, from a performance point of view, it's really difficult because I've worked on everything from people winning Olympic gold through to winning the Premier League, through to winning boxing world titles, winning to finishing your first marathon. So I personally enjoy kind of the amateur side of things slightly more than the elite side of things, personally speaking. But my best memory from a client success would probably be from last year, where we had an individual climb Everest in 13 days, Heathrow to Heathrow. So it's the quickest Western summit of the year. And that was a nice feeling. That was probably 18 months worth of work went into one venture. I didn't get a lot of sleep on that summit night. My wife was not impressed, but I sat there with the dog downstairs just watching this tracker very, very slowly climb from camp 3 to camp 4 to the top of Everest. But yeah, that would probably be my one. And then getting down was the bigger worry. But once I got that text message that he was safe, that was a nice feeling. That
we didn't talk at all about any of the high mountain stuff that you guys do, but we might have to leave that one for another time.
Yeah, that's a whole different conversation.
Nick, thank you so much for all your time and your insights. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure everyone else appreciates it too. And just a reminder to anybody, if you want more information, then you can either head over to the Altitude Centre's website or head on to our website, and you can look into altitude training, physiological testing, or heat training, or on our partners page as well. You can have a look and check out the Altitude Centre there. They've got some really great resources, and something which, as you may be surprised to hear, we keep on reiterating, is actually very useful and accessible to all different athletes or different levels. So, Nick, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and your insight.
No, thank you very much. It was nice to have a chat about all things training. From a performance point of view, it's really difficult because I've worked on everything from people winning Olympic gold through to winning the Premier League, through to winning boxing world titles, to finishing your first marathon. So I personally enjoy kind of the amateur side of things slightly more than the elite side of things, personally speaking. But my best memory from a client success would probably be from last year, where we had an individual climb Everest in 13 days Heathrow to Heathrow. So it's the quickest Western summit of the year. And that was a nice feeling. That was probably 18 months worth of work went into one venture. I didn't get a lot of sleep on that summit night. My wife was not impressed, but I sat there with the dog downstairs just watching this tracker very, very slowly climb from camp 3 to camp 4 to the top of Everest. But that would probably be my one. And then getting down was the bigger worry. But once I got that text message that he was safe, that was a nice feeling, that one.
We didn't talk at all about any of the high mountain stuff that you guys do.
Yeah, that's a whole different conversation.
For another time. Nick, thank you so much for all your time and your insights. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure everyone else appreciates it too. And just a reminder to anybody, if you want more information, then you can either head over to the Altitude Centre's website or head on to our website and you can look into altitude training, physiological testing or heat training, or on our partners page as well. You can have a look and check out the Altitude Centre there. They've got some really great resources, and something which, as you may be surprised to hear, we keep on reiterating, is actually very useful and accessible to all different athletes or different levels. So, Nick, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
No, thank you very much.
And your insight.
Nice to have a chat about all things training.
What a great episode we had here, Philip. What are your biggest intakes on this one?
So, I think I mentioned it the pre-episode part, where I think that this really reinforced to me how useful and effective the extreme environments can be for athletes of all levels. It doesn't necessarily need to sit down as someone who's just at the elite end of the racing. The bit which I find really interesting, I guess, as a coach, was some of the points around heat training. The fact that actually people respond negatively to heat at a much lower temperature than they may have realized, and people may have realized before. So most people, myself included, will sort of sit there going, you know, anything where you're kind of sweating out of every single sweat gland you have in your body and you're dripping it, that's heat training. You know, that's when you need to be thinking about racing in hot environments. But actually, it's probably about 20 degrees colder than that. So for me, that was a really big and interesting angle, which I think not many people will necessarily realize. And I think there's a lot of other interesting areas around the altitude part of what we were talking about just now, you know, looking into altitude as a as an enabler and ability to actually train more effectively, especially for that athlete who's really busy and they don't have the time to say, well, you know what, I'm just going to go and add an extra 5 hours of training because I've got that time. So what else can you do to try and be effective with your time and get the maximal gains you can without being able to add on more training loads just through more hours, because not everybody has more hours. Sure, the elite athletes are talking about environmental training, extreme environment training from a perspective of this is a, you know, this is a way of eking out the last bit of percentage points, but actually looking at it from a different angle and saying, well, actually, as long as you're, you know, able to ride a bike and all this sort of some more fundamental aspects of fitness, if you're looking at something which is environmental training, so heat training or altitude training, either around injury or potentially around being able to do it as a way of getting a little bit more training cardiovascularly in the system, I think it could be a really, really useful tool for many athletes, actually, along with those who wanting to try and reach the top and get those performance levels.
If people want to know a little bit more about Nick and the altitude training and the heat adaption, how can they do it?
So they can have a look at our website. Anywhere on our website, we've got the links through to the altitude chamber, one of the services we have on offer now, and coached athletes do get a nice little discount with them, which is very kind of the Altitude Centre. So thank you, guys. You can go onto any of the services on athlete services page and have a look and see what they are, be that the physiological testing section or the heat training section or the altitude training section. They can go and click on that, find out a little bit more, or go and have a look at the partner section as well to go straight onto their webpage.
Perfect. Thank you so much. See you next time.
Thanks, Diego.
Much.
The Believe, Strive, Achieve podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at trytraininghardware.com. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Try Training Harder. Thanks for listening!